Welcome to T-Bone Speaks with Dr. Tarun Agarwal, where our goal is to change the way you practice dentistry by helping you achieve clinical, financial, and personal balance. Now, here's your host, T-Bone.
All right, everybody. Welcome back for another episode. And today, I have got Dr. Max Johnson with us. Max is a practicing dentist in Tucson, Arizona, pronounced Tucson. And I first met Max at one of our training courses here in Raleigh, and he's gone back and I followed him on Facebook and stuff. And I wanted to bring him back on so that way we could kind of talk about what he's doing. So Max, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Tarun. I appreciate you having me on.
Hey, where is your accent from, by the way?
You know, it's probably Tucson, you know, but my whole family's from North Dakota. So I think if anybody
No, that's what I hear. I hear the North Dakota in you.
You get a little bit of it, especially this time of the year, because I've got family in town that come down for the winter months. And so spending time with grandpa and grandma, you get a little bit of that accent, don't you know? And well, yeah.
When my parents come to visit and stuff, I start getting the head bob and stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I start doing the Indian head bob and stuff.
So. And especially too with the patient's demographic and things that we see, we get a lot of people that come from the upper north. So Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota. And so after a full day of working with them, you pick up the accent and they find yourself speaking just like they do by the end of the day. So it happens certainly. So you probably is catching that. And it's probably got a little bit of Texas in it because, you know, I grew up in Texas before moving out here to Arizona. So I spent 12 or 13 years in Texas. So it's maybe a little bit of a hybrid between.
Speaking of which, have they started building the wall out where you're at?
The wall actually exists down here. No, coincidentally, for most of the state, there's just little parts here and there on some of the tribal lands and things that actually doesn't have a wall. But that's, for whatever reason, apparently Tucson and there's a small town called Nogales, maybe about an hour south of here, where apparently that's the popular place to do news footage from or shoot video from, because we've had a ton of people here from news organizations and things in the area and going down to film segments and things on the wall. So we'll see how things are going. I know I read an article about Texas, so we'll see how they do out there going forward. But I know there is a literal wall. If I drive here to San Diego, you drive along the actual wall.
Is it beautiful from the U.S. side?
It looks no different from one side to the other. I've heard stories of people driving across without even knowing it. Yeah, at this point, there's not much difference when you look across the border.
Well, you know, to our listeners, all joking aside, I wanted to bring Max on because what I've seen as a young practitioner, I see him doing unique and neat things that are helping his practice grow. I see him implementing some of the things that older dentists wish should be implementing and aren't implementing. And I see him implementing at a high level. And quite honestly, my take on you, Max, and we haven't spent a lot of time personally together, but my take on you is from your Facebook is that you're trying things. You're not afraid to try things, see if it happens, see if it sticks, see if it works. So I wanted to bring that on and kind of get an idea of somebody that, okay, basically, a lot of our focus will be on sleep with you. Not a lot, but we'll start with that. For somebody that was doing essentially no sleep to someone now that's doing a good number of sleep, at least for a newbie in that, I think that would be fantastic. But before we get started there, tell me who is Max Johnson and, you know, briefly, how'd you get into dentistry and how'd you end up in Tucson?
So I am a person who grew up, like I said, in Texas. I have no medical personnel in the family at all. My mom's an accountant. Dad works for the government. And so growing up, it was just something simple. And you know what? Dentistry for me came about, in all honesty, it might be kind of silly, but dentistry came about because I knew I wanted to do something medically related coming into college and things. Going into it, I was playing some sports there at the university and just kind of happened to go through the prerequisites for anything medical. And as I was going through it, I met my dentist here in the area. And every time I seemed to visit him, he was up front drinking coffee and reading the paper. And I thought, shoot, if he's sitting here doing this all day, this might be the thing.
Was he an orthodontist?
No, he was a general practitioner. But he had, you know, his dad was a dentist, his brother was a dentist, so his whole family were dentists. So he was just hanging out, living the life. And I thought, man, if that's what it means to be a dentist, that seems pretty nice. I love reading the paper, I love coffee. So for me, that was a good deal. So I thought, well, let's see what this is all about. So when I was in school, I ended up quit playing football so I could focus on the grades because I realized how I had to do in school to be able to get into dental school. So I focused on things and I was fortunate enough to get in. And as I got in, I, you know, the more I have practiced and the more I do in dentistry, the more I actually really, really enjoy what I do. And so I'm fortunate in the sense that I was happened to stumble into it, but it's really paid off in spades for me. I'm very, very fortunate, very thankful to what I have here in the office and here as a professional career. But for me, you know what, I practice down here in Tucson, Arizona. I've got a wife who's also a dentist here. We've got a 6-month-old. And so for me, it's just a matter of playing dad a couple, you know, whenever I get the opportunity to, when I'm not working. I do enjoy quite a bit of fitness and things. So I was a big runner all the way through dental school. And
me too.
And exactly. I see. Well, and you and I may be on the same track because I think I'm heading a certain kind of way these days. So I recently picked up cycling. I just got bored running every day. So I picked up cycling. So I've done some cycling and things here in Tucson's a great place for that. So I'm able to get out on the road a couple days a week and ride the bike. And so I've started doing that. And so it's been a great time, you know, and actually I started golfing a little bit. So I know you're here and things.
We have to play.
Hey, anytime, man. I did a little bit in high school and a little bit in college after I quit playing football because I needed something athletic. And now that I've got a little bit more time and I'm not in school or not doing different things, I can actually get out and play a little bit. And I'm fortunate my office is maybe a stone's throw from the course. So I literally walk over if I want to at the end of the day and play 9. So it's been a good deal.
So but, yeah. How old are you, Max?
I just turned 30 years old as of February. So I'm a ripe old age of 30.
And so you are a practice owner.
I am. Yeah.
And how long have you owned your practice?
So I have just started year 3. I bought the office in January of 2015. So we've had 2 years finished.
So you were 27?
I was 27 when I bought it. Yep.
Okay. So you went to dental school at UNLV.
Mm-hmm.
You graduated what year?
I graduated 2013 from UNLV.
Okay, 2013, you graduated UNLV, and then after that, you did a GPR?
Correct. I was graduating dental school, and I thought, you know what, I spent my entire time in the west or southwest part of the country, and so for me, I wanted to take the opportunity to just see a completely different aspect of things, see a different side of dentistry. I'd heard rumors that the East Coast dentistry was different than West Coast dentistry, you know, kind of like
East side versus West side.
Yeah, exactly, kind of like the rap battle.
Tupac versus Biggie.
There you go. So I thought I'd go out east and see what all the hype was about. So I applied to GPR programs up and down the East Coast and was fortunate to get into my top choice there. And I actually spent the year in Allentown, Pennsylvania at the Lehigh Valley Hospital and general practice residency there in Pennsylvania. So I spent a year out there just doing some different things at a hospital and enjoying that. Really got a good, very, very good education with the time I was there. So
do you regret going to a GPR at all?
Not at all. You know what? I graduated in a position at school where I had some options and things. I was fortunate enough to do well enough in dental school that I could kind of pick and choose what I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to do general dentistry. I didn't want to specialize just because of the fact that I enjoyed doing a little bit of everything. And so when I went into practice, I thought, well, I've got some time. I can spend a year doing some different things and learning some more without the pressures of having to pay back student debt, without having to produce or do dentistry for a corporation, you know, so to speak. So I spent the time out east, and I got a ton of information, a ton of education that I maybe wouldn't have gotten if I jumped right into practice. So I'm very fortunate, very happy with my experience out at the GPR, and really appreciated the time that it allowed me to gain more information and really develop as a clinician.
Did you learn IV sedation there?
So I didn't learn how to. I did do some IV sedation. The way that the hospital program worked is we had anesthesiologists come down to the emergency room, or we'd go up into the ER and operate there. But I didn't myself do any of the actual sedation, no. But I think that was probably the one thing that I didn't do.
Surgically, you guys did wisdom teeth and everything?
Anything and everything you wanted to. And that was the big thing for me was we've got a great team of people who volunteer their time there at the hospital. And so it was nice that I could go in there. Any case that you felt, you know, like you wanted to try or attempt, you just had to set it up on the appropriate day with the appropriate kind of faculty overseeing you, and they were more than willing to share you with their time and to help you kind of proceed through cases and treatment plan and do those types of things. And so, you know, whether it's impacted wisdom teeth, surgery, implants, anything I wanted to try or do, they were all up for, and they more than donated their time. So I got to do anything and everything I really wanted to. The other nice thing was the hospital had its own kind of internal health insurance and dental insurance program. And so when we talked about treatment plans and presenting treatment, the money was really not a big hindrance to being able to do the types of dentistry and doing the types of things that we wanted to there at the program. So it allowed me the chance to just treatment plan what I wanted to do and work with the patient to come up with the best treatment plans for them and then go through that process of getting it taken care of. And it gave me the experience to do almost, give me a full scope of dentistry.
So wow, that's awesome. Yeah.
No, it was fantastic. And when you take money out of the equation, it makes for a good experience for patients and them not having to really pay for a whole lot of the treatment. You get some good options. You get some good things that you can do for patients.
Yeah. So, all right. So after GPR, you went back to Tucson or you went to Tucson.
Yep. My whole family's here. So I decided I had a good time out on the East Coast, but the snow was not for me. When I wake up and it's 0 degrees, I thought that's a little cold for me. So I moved back here to Tucson and started working for a corporation on a full-time basis as I looked for a potential practice to buy.
So you knew right out of GPR that you wanted to buy a practice?
Yeah, coming out of dental school, I had seen things and, you know, talking to the dentist that inspired me to become a dentist, seeing how he ran things and seeing how his experience and things were. It was one of the things that I knew coming out of it. I didn't want to be an associate. I didn't want to work for somebody else in any capacity for that matter. And so I knew right out of the boat that I wanted to be an owner. It's just a matter of how I got to ownership. And so it was a thing of, can I find somebody who is at a point in their career where they're ready to retire and I can transition in as an associate with the potential to own, or do I find somebody who's just, you know, they're ready to retire and that was that. So the market here in Tucson was such that not a lot of older dentists were ready to transition. They either wanted to be done and retire right away, or they weren't ready to sell at all. So for me, there wasn't that intermediary ground where I could buy somebody's practice or buy into a practice with a phased out approach. So
why didn't you consider opening from scratch, or did you?
I didn't even think about it, to be completely honest. As I think back now in hindsight, that might have been a more viable option. But the market here in Tucson's not a very big community. And it's kind of a unique dental community in the sense that you have, I feel like, a lot of dentists who maybe they come from other parts of the country. They retire, say, you know, they retire from the north and they move here as a semi-retirement, and they maybe work for another decade or so before permanently retiring. So there are a lot of older dentists. So the potential to buy practices is very high here in town. And so it's I think for me, as I looked at it and evaluated, and it may have been I just naive. I didn't know better at the time. But as I came out here, I was looking at, there were a handful of practices for sale. And so I didn't even feel the need, maybe. If there wasn't anything that I could find that I liked or anything out there that was working for me from a practice standpoint, then I think I might have considered startup. But, you know, with where I was at personally, I don't know if startup would have been a viable option. I think that same year, as I bought the practice in 15, I also got married in 15. My wife got pregnant in 2015. I bought a house in 2015. So I went full bore 2015. And so for me, economically, starting a practice from scratch might have been a little tough, because I know there are some cash flow and some things required. And so when this practice actually came about that I'm in now, it actually kind of worked out, or it seemed to be kind of an ideal circumstance. So I just continued to roll with that and work towards practice ownership of the one I'm in now.
All right. So let's talk about your practice since we're there. How would you describe your practice?
So we are a practice that I would consider as a patient-centered or patient-oriented full-service dental practice. We offer essentially anything and everything to patients. I generally tend to keep most things in-house. I have tended recently to kind of get away from endo, because we found an endodontist that's just maybe two blocks away that does a fantastic job, and he's much more efficient at it than I am. And so I just simply haven't had the time.
When you say efficient, what do you mean by that?
Well, he's able to have patients in and out of the door and able to see patients same day for me and be done with their, you know, the RCT in about an hour. And so for me, it's been much more economically viable to have patients go over there, take the half-mile road up or drive up the road to see him, have the RCT completed, and then come back and see me for the crown buildup or whatever necessitated following his treatment. Because for me, as I've looked at things, and after, you know, the time that I've spent looking at and trying to provide endo as a service here in the practice, I just wasn't efficient enough. I couldn't make it work at dollars and cents. And part of that comes down to the fee schedules and the insurance profile that I had to begin when I opened the practice. Part of that is the fact that the demographics that we see, most patients are 60 to 80 years old with crowns and that are on the teeth, or existing crowns and canals that are calcified and closed shut. So for me, it made just more sense, and it was less stress on me personally as a provider in the practice than trying to sit there and fiddle with these. Then I can just send them out and have somebody else take care of it for me, do it better, do it faster, and do it easier for the patient.
You mean there's no young people in Tucson?
There are certainly young people in Tucson. I think when you look at where I'm at, so I'm kind of on the outside of town here in the suburbs, in the northwest part of town, and where I'm at, I'm situated kind of between about three or four different retirement communities. So the younger population and the younger demographics here in the area tend to skew more central Tucson. So we certainly do see some, you know, younger families and things, but for the most part, the patients that I see tend to be older. Now, having said that, the only thing that I don't do endodontically are molars. I'll do everything else, premolars, anteriors, and whatnot.
Oh, so you do the easy ones?
Yeah, I do the easy.
Easier, I should say.
Yeah, but so we do, you know, I do anteriors, I do premolars and things. Now, having said that, if patient asks me to do it, I have no problem doing molars. It's just for the time it takes me to do it, I'd have to book out a little bit
more
time.
Are you a Sarek office?
I am not a Sarek office. Nope. But I've got a unique perspective on it, and I think in a sense that the practitioner that was here before I bought the office did have a Sarek. He purchased the Sarek, maybe 8 months before deciding to sell the office. So he had a nice new, brand new loan to it and a nice note on that Sarek and the milling unit. And he actually took that with him when he left and went on to his next gig. And so I've seen some of the I'd like to say I've seen more of the bad than the good here in the practice.
But he was only 8 months in.
He was 8 months in, but in that 8 months, I spent some of the first year maybe correcting some of the things.
Let me ask you this. When you buy a practice and you see old – I didn't buy a practice. I started from scratch. And you see older dentistry from your predecessor that's failing, or let's say not even older dentistry, but relatively newer dentistry.
Mm-hmm.
Are you obligated to redo that at no charge?
So I think it comes down to your personal preference. I think looking at it, we had a worked out arrangement that he was going to go ahead and remill. So any of the Sareks that he did, he would remill and cement on his own dime because he had the unit. He could mill them out and have it to go and be ready. Now, the problem came about the fact that he was maybe an hour away from the practice now. And so I'm not going to send a patient an hour away to get a crown remade for them. So what I ended up doing is a lot of the time, if it was within the last 2 years, or if I deemed it a mechanical failure, much less more of a biological failure, then I would just replace it at no charge to the patient. I'd eat the cost on the lab bill and just get it replaced because I thought their time and effort was more valuable to me than having to send them somewhere else. So I valued them being able to trust me and get the quality that I thought was appropriate out of their crown and get the longevity and the sustainability out of it than me sending them somewhere else to have the same poor crown remade, maybe.
I got you.
So for me, I didn't mind remaking it. I think it stunk because I could tell you there were maybe a dozen or two dozen crowns that I remade over the first year.
Oh, that's not that bad.
Not that bad? Well, hey, I'll take that then. But, when another one failed, it was a little frustrating because, you re-impress, you have to explain to the patient, hey, you had this crown done 6 months ago or 8 months ago. It fell off or it broke in half. I'm going to have to, send this back out or get a new crown made that's maybe a little bit more durable or whatever the case may be. And so patients, I think, understood and they appreciated it. But I think for them, they were kind of a little annoyed that they had to have a brand new crown remade. But it's since worked out. I think now, after 2 years of it, now we're into year three. I think we are hard pressed to find any issues or any concerns now after this point in time. So we've kind of weeded out those cases that were maybe not ideal for Sarek or and you may be a better judge of it than I, but that just didn't work out the way that was maybe intended when the crown was milled originally.
All right. So talk to me about your procedure mix in the practice, when you bought it and say now.
Yeah, of course. So when I bought the practice, the office itself was doing some Invisalign. The previous dentist was doing some implant placements and things. I think he was relatively new in the surgical aspect of it. He was doing the Sarek unit crowns and things. So when I bought it, I didn't have any Invisalign training. Didn't have any Invisalign training. I'd done implants, but with the way that our practice sale worked out, he had to keep a lot of the equipment to make the note work and to make the sale work. So keeping his endo equipment, he ended up keeping his implant equipment. I'm not an Invisalign provider, so a lot of those things didn't carry over. Luckily, we didn't have any active Invisalign cases and things. So when I jumped into the practice, I offered essentially just a general restorative practice with the addition of 6 months smiles because I had taken the course back in November. I had done some different things to get ready for it, but I hadn't actually started any cases. And so when I jumped into the practice, we ended up purchasing the endodontic equipment again. So we had endo equipment and we had short-term ortho that we were offering patients right off from the get-go. As the year progressed, we ended up purchasing the implant motor and implant equipment And so that was maybe the fall of 15 that we started offering implants as a service here in the practice.
Even though you had done some in your residency?
Correct. Yeah. It just economically, I didn't have the cash flow to buy the equipment necessary to do the placements and things. So a lot of that first year was spent referring out to the local oral surgeon to have implants.
Oh, placed. So you did a lot of custom abutments and cemented restorations.
Exactly.
On angled implants.
Yeah, exactly. So that was my first year, is essentially just referring out a lot of the cases that I thought, you know, shoot, this is something I could have easily done had I had the equipment. So when we got to a point where we paid off the endo equipment, then I turned around and bought surgery equipment. And so now we have worked on that. So we've been offering implants for the last year and some change now. And then as of August last year, when I came out to your course, that's when we started to offer sleep apnea here in the practice and doing some things from that aspect of things. And we started medical billing for a lot of the procedures come as of November.
Okay.
And that was at your course as well. So I would like to say there isn't anything I won't do. I do as much.
What do you enjoy doing, though?
I really do enjoy the surgical aspect of things. So for me, implants are a lot of fun. I really enjoy that because for me, that's something different than just the
drill. But it helps that they pay well, too.
That's a nice little bonus. Yeah, I could imagine. And so that, and then the other thing is short-term ortho. I enjoy it not so much for the, you know, I want this tooth turned or that tooth turned. I enjoy it because it allows me to do some different things with the surgical cases that we do here in the practice.
Right. It gives you flexibility even on your cosmetic restorative cases.
Exactly. You know, I've used it a lot to try to get teeth uprighted in the anterior to make space for an implant placement. I've done some things in that regard or just moving a few things here or there. So for me, those two in combination work well. And sleep apnea has been a thing that I've really taken a hold to, and it may just be coincidence that we're talking about it, but, you know, from my personal family's history, I think, you know, growing up, I've heard mom and dad snore and woke me up. You know, I'm sitting there trying to watch TV and mom's snoring on the couch next to me. It makes things tough. So when this came about, it was a welcomed offering and something I took a hold to because it's personal. I think when you think about what it can do for you and both in a mental state and a health state, I think it's something that I really enjoy doing. So those are kind of the three things that I really enjoy. And I think any general practitioner.
Which ortho class did you take?
So I did the 6 month smiles.
Okay.
So I've done 6 month smiles, and that's who we've continued to use. Right. I did that, like I said, maybe November of 14. So I did that prior to ever purchasing the practice because I knew that was going to be something that I wanted to be able to offer. So while I was an employee, I went out and sought out and paid for the course out of pocket and just took the course to be able to get that as an option when I bought into the practice or bought a practice. So we did that and who we've set with since. We do some short-term stuff through Great Lakes and some little things here on the side, but for the most part, the ortho's offerings that we have here in the practice are through 6 month smiles.
So you don't do a lot of Invisalign?
Been one of those things that I wanted to do. I just haven't done the course for it yet. It's on the to-do list. I've got a wish list of CE stuff that I want to do. And it's just a matter of prioritizing what I want to do.
Let's talk about your wish list. What is your wish list?
Yeah, of course. So for me, you know, if you don't mind names and things.
I don't mind at all.
Okay. So for me, one of the big things is Justin Moody's course.
You want to take the implant pathway course?
That's on my to-do list here as I go through things. Just because I've done a lot of the simple implant stuff. Most of what we do here is graft and replace type implants.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting more into the immediate placements of implants, but I don't do any of the full arch type stuff. I don't do any sinus lifts and things. And so those are types of things that I'd like to be able to offer patients here in the practice, and we just haven't gotten to that level yet. So that's one thing that I'd like to be able to do. The Invisalign is another thing because there are some patients that are adverse to brackets and things, regardless of how you know aesthetic they may be considered. Patients don't want that kind of thing. Some of the stuff with more complex restorative things, being like I said, with the demographics that we see, the older population, we do get a lot of patients that come in with, you know, they've had one crown every 3 or 4 years, and so when you look back at it now, you've got an occlusal plane that's all over the place. So maybe like out in New Jersey, I'm drawing a blank on his name all of a sudden. Not Coyce, but Nosty.
John Nosty, yeah.
Yeah, he's got some stuff
out there. The clinical mastery, I think, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I know I came
back. That's John, Leanne Brady, and a couple other people, yeah.
Yeah, there's a group of four of them. I did their stuff at the Dental Town Conference last year, so I know I want to get out there at some point to do some of their stuff.
And Spear's not too far from you as well.
No, I do Spear stuff online right now.
Okay.
I do like online things and their CE there, so I do that on a frequent basis. But yeah, I agree. Getting up to the actual Spear Institute to do some of their things there in person and some of their live sessions would be a big benefit to me here in the practice. So those are probably the big four, I think, as I think back to what I'd like to do. And maybe even continuing with the short-term ortho stuff, being able to offer more complex cases or take that level two course from 6 months miles, just to be able to be more confident in what we're doing here in the practice, if maybe be able to finish cases a little faster. Or be more, you know, as we're talking about some of the cases and things, be more confident and talk to patients about what we can offer them.
Yeah. And then what thoughts have you given in terms of like courses that help you talk to patients better in communication and treatment planning, treatment presentation courses?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. I think looking at it, I've really just been, it's been nothing other than books.
Like what?
There's a guy out of England. He's got two books.
Oh, Ashley Latter.
Yes, thank you. Ashley Latter, I've read his books. I've read some different things like the E-Myth Revisited things. You know, one of the other things, too, from an educational perspective, is just listening to podcasts. I'm a big podcaster, and that's, I think, how I came about or came familiar with you. And so I listen to podcasts every day on the way back and forth from work and things. I'm trying to get some experience from listening to other practitioners or clinicians who have been doing it longer than I, trying to hear what works for them and what doesn't work for them. But from a simply just a patient management or patient educational standpoint, really, I don't have anything that I've come across that I thought, you know what, this is something I want to do or even something I've been made aware of. And I'm not averse to it. So if there's something that you've got.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Love,
I'd love the opportunity.
Yeah, you know, I think the reason I asked about that is it's an area of personal frustration for me, having had associates your age in my practice. Mm-hmm. And what I found is most people, not just your age, actually any age, they spend very little time on learning how to communicate with patients and how to lead patients to accept treatment. Personally, I don't think there's anybody better at it than Paul Homley. You know, I think buy $10 for his 6-hour MP3 file at paulhomley.com is great. I think $20 for his book you can get on Amazon is great. And then certainly from there, if you want to take some of his workshops, those would be great recommendations. I think what you'll see, since you offer such a broad range of services, is going to be that you're going to have to start what I call shifting your practice to the right. You're going to have to start learning that there's the general part of your practice and a non-general part of your practice. And you're going to have to start recognizing those people. And you're going to have to start understanding that your communication skills to those right-sided patients is going to be very different than the communication skills to your left-sided patients. And you're going to have to understand that you have to take people through the four quadrants, which is people that are aware of their problems and don't want to do anything about it versus people that are unaware and don't know what's going on versus being aware and not wanting to do something versus being aware and wanting to do something about it. So there's things like that. You know, some of this stuff can be sometimes a little bit, it can come across a little bit cheesy, but I find it, even at this stage, let's see, I first took his class probably 8 years ago now, 10 years ago. Wow. 10 years ago. I still read his book every year.
Do you really just reread it, huh?
Yeah, I reread his book and I re-listen to his MP3 file. I would say that having invested in the time and the energy in that has paid off spades for me in terms of my ability to communicate and recognize what the patient's fit issue, what the true chief complaint is, you know, what their hot buttons are, things like that, that are fantastic. And, you know, I just bought some of Ashley Latter's stuff as well. I haven't made it through it yet. Mm-hmm. I haven't actually unwrapped it yet, but that is hopefully on vacation next week. I can get through some of that.
Let me ask you this then. So, you know, you're at a point in your career where you've done a few things that I haven't. So how much of this, you know, learn, because that's a big thing for me is being in the practice for the 2 years that I have, I know I can see it in myself. There's a big difference from the first year being a young clinician, trying to talk to patients and you're trying to explain things. And so I'm figuring it out almost just as much as they are. And so how much of it do you find that you learn on the job or as you go through things every year? And how much of it is something that I can learn in a book, or how much, you know, you can read until you're blue in the face, but there's that transition where you've actually got to implement it. And so, you know, how much of that comes from each side of the thing, do you think?
Let me give you a political answer. Okay. And my intention isn't to be that, but it's both because, You know, my dad used to tell me that, it's funny, I just interviewed another associate tonight because I want to add a third dentist to the practice, but that's a different story. You have to have both. You can't put the horse before the cart or the cart before the horse, and they kind of simultaneously go together. My dad used to get on me about all the clinical education I was taking very early in my career. And he's like, why are you wasting so much money and time on this when you don't have the patience to even do the work? And what I would always come back with was, well, if I don't know what it is I can do, I can never see it and diagnose it. So if all you have is a hammer, all you have is a nail, all you see are nails. And so I want to have a whole toolbox. So part of the challenge is making good choices in your CE and making practical choices in your CE. And so, you know, I would look at you and say, to be honest with you, one of the first things you should learn how to do with everybody is learn how to communicate better. Then you need to learn how to do molar endo in an efficient manner. And then I would start looking at how can I expand services, soft tissue grafting, you know, more sinus lifts, external sinus lifts, things like that that support some of the procedures that you're doing, maybe some adolescent orthodontics, things like that that start expanding the practice and adding more things that you do. So it's about making the right choices and then also having a good mix of CE that you can actually do.
So let me ask you this, because this is something I struggle with personally with regards to CE, is, you know, I've got a wide variety, or I'd like to think I have a wide variety of services that we offer here in the practice. Now, at this point in things, do you think it's better to focus on what I'm already doing and get better at what I'm already doing, or to continue to expand, like you referred to, continue to look into
parallel? Why can't you do both?
Well, it's just the thing. I mean, when you're looking at it, time and money play a part into things. And so when you're considering your CE list for the year, for example, because I like to plan out, we plan out things here in the practice 6 months in advance or things. And so
you have to
find out. It's one of those things, you know, there's only so much time. And so as I look at it, I've been trying to expand services for the last 2 years after buying into the practice. And so now it's, do I sit back and maybe not expand as much and maybe improve the quality of what I'm offering? Or do I continue to expand or some sort of the both, some sort of a hybrid in the sense that continue to expand while at the same time improving and continuing to take courses on things I'm already doing?
Look, there's no right or wrong answer to this, okay?
Mm-hmm. No, and,
but the right answer is you do both. You do everything, right? Okay.
You get better and you do more.
Right. But see, I always look at it as you have to practice within your market. So, for example, let's just go with this, okay? You practice in a market of 50-plus-year-olds.
Roughly,
okay,
yeah.
Your patient, typical patient base, okay? So for you to go learn how to do adolescent orthodontics may not make the most sense, okay? Right. Because that's probably not a service that really fits your practice profile, okay? So to me, I would look at it from that perspective. I would, you know, I would say, okay, so the implant pathway program makes sense because you can expand your implant services, and that seems to fit the age group and the market that you're in. You seem to be doing well with the sleep, so I would continue to learn and advance on the sleep thing. So I would kind of fine-tune what I expand on, but at the mm-hmm. same time, bringing in a little bit more. And it's a little bit hard for me to say this because everything's in context. I'm at I don't want to say age. I mean, I'm only 41 years old, okay? But I'm at a career stage where my focus now is to truly love and enjoy everything that I do.
Uh-huh.
So everything for me is about finding my why or finding my, what I love to do. And okay. For you, that's part of it, but it's also about, hey, I got a practice note. I got a life. I got a wife. I got kids. You know, it's not as, you know, these decisions when I was your age were not the same decisions I was making today. So, you know, as a person that gives advice, I have to kind of keep some of that in mind as well. It's again, going back to, it's about choices you make, you know, so I would say that your choices should always be made with in mind of what will this do to my practice or how will this benefit my practice and my patients?
Okay. So
I mentioned wife. So you had mentioned briefly that your wife is a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys meet in dental school?
So we did. Yep. She actually graduated in 2015. So she's a newer graduate even than I am.
So when you were in Pennsylvania, she was in dental school?
Yep, I made many a red eye from Vegas back to Philly and back and forth.
At least it's a nonstop flight.
It was pretty easy. Fly into Vegas, then back into Philly, and drive up to work the next morning. So it worked out pretty well, but I certainly made my fair share of flights. And thank God for FaceTime, because that came about shortly before and grew into popularity while she was in school and things. And so we were able to FaceTime most nights and see each other, much like I'm seeing your smiling face now.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how we made that work. And then when I moved back to Tucson in 2014, then it just made it a different trip. Instead of flying back and forth from Philly, I drove up and back from Tucson to Vegas, made the 5-hour trip every other week, and just spent time together on the weekends when we could, because she was still in dental school.
That's good. And so does she work in your practice?
So no. Not at all. We both agreed coming into it that I was going to do my thing, she was going to do her thing, and so we never actually practiced together, and I don't think we ever will. I've learned she's much more cutthroat when it comes to business than I am.
You want that in your practice.
I didn't say it was wrong, but I tend to be, you know, the guy that's, hey, you know, that's okay, we'll get you next time, or hey, there's no worry, don't worry about that charge or this charge. And so when I go home and tell her that, I certainly get a good stern talking to about what I need to be billing for and why I didn't bill for this or that. So I do get my fair share. So we just agreed going into it that, you know what, I'll let her do her and I'll do me. And so we get to come home at every night and talk
and
about
so
everything.
So she works for someone else, or she has her own practice?
Nope, she's an employee for a small corporation here in the Western region.
When you say small corporation, what is that? 30 offices?
Yeah, roughly. They're primarily based out of Colorado, New Mexico.
So when did 30 offices become small?
Well, I guess in the relative.
No, yeah, you're right. In the scheme of things, it is a pretty small size DSO.
When you have the Aspens and the Pacifics or the Heartlands in the world, they are what I would consider a large group practice or large DSO. But she works for Perfect Teeth, is a company based out of Colorado,
and she enjoys it.
I think it allows her the freedom to do the types of things that she wants to do. So she doesn't have to stress out about being a practice owner. She doesn't have to worry about doing all the odds and ends that come with being a business owner.
Do you ever wish you were like that sometimes?
Mm-hmm. No. I got to experience it for the first 6 months after dental school. You know, when I first moved back, before I purchased the office, it comes with freedom, but it's a trade-off. You know, you're an employee. So at the time when you want to take trips or want to do things with the family, you've got to ask permission. And so for me, that was the biggest thing that I just didn't want to have to do. I don't want to have to ask anybody permission if I want to take a trip and go do this my wife and I, we take a trip every year and go somewhere out of the country and just spend time together for 10 days. And so with me being a practice owner, I can basically set my own schedule and say, hey, I'm leaving this time. You know, don't put anybody on the books for this period of time and I'm going to be out of country. And so for me, that's what I wanted, and it allowed me the flexibility. For her, it's a little bit different. She doesn't have to stress about being owner. She doesn't have to worry about making payroll and things at the end of the week. And so she's able to show up at 8 o'clock, walk off at 5 o'clock, and then get to spend time with our kid and just enjoy not having to do all those other odds and ends that come with being an owner. So
do you guys talk a lot of dentistry at home?
More than I'd like, maybe more than I say we should, but yeah, we talk.
Oh, about you dentistry. Should be talking about dentistry all the time, man.
Well, we share cases and we share experiences and things, you know, how would you handle this or what would you do about that? And so, yeah, we give each other some.
Do you get tips from her? Not, I don't use the word tips, but.
No, that's a fair step. Yeah, she gives me some things that she's done in practice that I think, you know.
But even from a business perspective, you know, listen, large group practices, whatever we say about them, the one thing they do know how to do, and that is run, generally speaking, run very efficient practices.
Oh, no doubt. And I think part of that, you know, part of the benefit having worked for the same company, because I worked for the same company that she's now employed for, and I did that I worked full-time for them for 6 months, and then when I bought the practice, or after I bought the practice, I worked for them part-time for 18 months. So I got a good exposure to what they do and how they do it, so you can see what works from a big practice standpoint and what works from a business standpoint. So, I think talking to her and saying, hey, this is what we started doing, it's always nice because I kind of feel like I'm cheating the system because I get to see how they're doing things and what's working for them. And, you know, maybe they quit doing something a certain kind of way and she'll explain why. And so I've taken some of what I learned while I was an employee and implemented it here into the practice, whether that's how we do payroll or how we handle staffing and things. So those are some of the things that I had knew nothing about going into it. But then after working for them part of the time, I got to see how they handled certain aspects, and I just tried to copy it because I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel by any means. And so looking at what works, I do it here in my practice. And so talking to her You know, I'll run ideas. And the other thing too, from her, her parents are both small business owners, entrepreneurs. And so, you know, she's
they're Asian, to, aren't they?
They are.
Yeah. So, you know, what do they have? Dry cleaners?
No, they have restaurants.
Okay.
Up and down the West Coast, and so what restaurants and coffee shops and things. And so talking to them, she was exposed to the small business atmosphere from a young age. So she's had more experience than I have, and so she's done some different things and knows some different things than I do. So when I have ideas, I always run them by her first, just to get what her sense of things are and see how she would handle it.
I know why you really bought and own your own practice, and that's just to impress her parents.
Hey, you got to do what you got to do, you know?
Yeah, you want to make sure you keep them happy. Now let's get a little bit tough on each other, okay?
Please, let's do it.
All right, so what hurdles have you faced and how have you overcome them? If you were to say, hey, I bought a practice, what are the big hurdles you've had in your practice?
So coming into it, when I bought it, I think the biggest hurdle, and it's still a little bit, but not maybe quite as significant, was cash flow. I think buying a practice that was relatively small in size, just trying to make cash flow work on a month-to-month basis, still trying to have a little bit at the end of every month to pay myself was the biggest hurdle. And it was for the first maybe year and a half, 2 years of ownership. And so I think that was the biggest one. That's what stands out to me first off. And that goes along or corresponds with overhead and just trying to get that implemented.
How long before you were cash flow positive?
Cash flow positive, I would say, was probably 18 months.
18 months. So for the first 18 months, you didn't take home much of a salary?
Nope, not much of anything. You know, that the time I spent working as an employee, that's what covered my bills. So okay. I worked 2 days a week as an employee.
And your wife was still in dental school at the time?
Yep, exactly. Okay.
So you weren't even a two-income household at that time?
Nope, just solo. I lived at home with mom and dad because they're here in town. So while...
Oh, do they do laundry for you and cook food?
Mom's a great roommate, yeah. Let me tell you. Mom's a great roommate. She took care of me. She made sure that my clothes were washed and cleaned, and then there was food on the table when I came home at the end of the day. So I'm very fortunate, very appreciative. But yeah, I stayed at home. I tried to keep bills and things down to a minimum, and covered expenses on my end with the income I got from working at the small corporation. The 3 days I worked here covered the bills and paid the note on the practice and paid rent on the doors.
Okay, part of that was that you were working part time in your practice.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Patient flow just wasn't quite enough to really kind of carry a 4 day week or a 4 day week schedule. So for the first period there, that's kind of way it worked out. At the maybe at about the 9 month mark or 12 month mark of being an owner, there came a point where I started to take a draw every month and pay myself a little bit extra so I could save up a little something every month from the practice ownership. But by that point too, my wife had started working and she was earning a decent income from the corporation and things. So, you know, we weren't ever hurting for money, but there were a couple months where things were tight. You know, you just can't have a whole lot of extra income or disposable.
You got to eat macaroni and cheese, yeah.
Or ramen noodles, just depends on, you know, being that she's Asian, I had my fair share of ramen and things, so it was pretty good.
she's gonna kick your butt for that one, dude.
That's all right. I give her a hard time because she appreciates it. I think I tease her that I'm probably more Asian than she is because I enjoy more.
Well, I can see your eyes. They're open.
Thank you. she's actually Korean, so I give her a hard time that I enjoy more Korean food than she does. So
some of that barbecue is good, man.
Hey, you're telling me.
What area of your practice needs attention?
You know, looking at it or thinking about it, I guess how specific do you want me to be, I think? Because when I look at it, one of the big things for me is hygiene. You know, mm-hmm. Making sure that we're profitable from a hygiene perspective, mm-hmm. because with where we're at, making sure that our time is spent doing the things that need to be done to make it profitable, I think that's where I'm at. And as I go this part of the year, I try to evaluate things every year and look at things on a monthly basis, look at different systems here in the practice and see how things have changed from year to year and look at where we can improve this year compared to last. And so we're at a point now where we're looking at hygiene and trying to make sure that each visit is profitable. Because, you know, I have no shame in sense that when I bought the practice, there were capitation plans, there were HMO plans and things. And so there were a lot of times that I was receiving maybe $5
for. Have you gotten rid of all of those things?
Yep. We did that at the end of last year. Officially, we cut ties around July, but I had to let contracts and things expire.
So July 16 and essentially the end of 2016.
Yep, exactly. So now we're at a point where we're strictly PPO or fee for service here in the practice. And so that's done a big boost to our hygiene department. I think we went from averaging maybe $72 a visit, a hygiene visit, to now we're at maybe $124.
Okay, you're doing fine. So I want to give you a different perspective on the hygiene side of things. Listen, 80% of your diagnosis comes through hygiene. So I've never been one to really get unbelievably so focused on my hygiene production. Okay. And so look at it this way. If my hygienist spends a little extra time or focuses on the restorative dentistry and she helps a patient choose one crown, that's her entire day. So my advice is don't get wrapped up in, oh my God, my hygienists aren't producing 1500 a day, or, oh my God, my hygienists aren't producing 1200 a day, or, oh my God, they're not producing $1,000 a day. Take a big picture view of that and see kind of what they're bringing to the practice. Like in your specific case, are your hygienists doing a good job of bringing up the sleep conversation? And are they putting people into the funnel and helping people move to the next step? Because quite honestly, one sleep appliance from your hygienist is like 2 or 3 days of production. Always look at it from that perspective, not from a, you know, drive them to solely focus on the production side of things.
I'll have to update you that, because I think I heard, one of your recent podcasts that I listened to stated something similar. And so we have our monthly huddles, our monthly meetings. And that was one of the things that I posed to them, and essentially was that very same sentiment. If you can talk to patients and expose patients to what sleep apnea can do for them or how they can be improved, and you get that appliance going or get it into the pipeline, then shoot, that covers your day's production, you know, because
that, yeah, just imagine, I mean, I think this is a little unrealistic, but imagine your hygienist did one a day.
Oh, yeah. You were talking about having I think you talked about it in the past, having a hygienist that can do that solely or exclusively.
Yeah. Or any team member. We call them champions.
Exactly.
Yeah. So don't get too caught up on that. I know some of the old school gurus are like, your hygienists have to be doing 5x what they pay. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, I look at it as, what do you bring to my practice? You know, I'm in a PPO environment. Look, we're lucky to get $100 per patient visit. You know, we're fortunate to do $1,000 a day in hygiene collections. Okay. So, you know, realistically, you look at that. So let's talk about the sleep stuff for a second. Okay.
Sure.
So, a couple of things. I say let's talk about sleep, and maybe this is kind of related. So what stuck out to me on your website was you do these weekly videos for your practice. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, the weekly videos thing just came about because I think, if for those who are familiar, Facebook started introducing their Facebook Live.
Right. People.
And we were fortunate enough to be one of the early kind of beta testers, I guess, for it. And so when with the practice here, it was one of those things, because for us, as I looked at things, money and cash flow was always consideration. So it's like, this is something cheap I can do. It doesn't cost me any money to do it. And we get questions that come about from patients all day long, like everybody else does, I'm sure. And you get the same question maybe 10 or 12 times a week. So it's something where I thought, well, instead of having to answer that question every single time during the day, I thought, what's a maybe easier way to get it out to patients, give people explanations and understanding, and then maybe be able to interact with patients on a day, on a weekly
basis. Do it live.
I do it live. Yeah. I think that's essentially, because I know if I have to sit there and film it and record it, I'm not going to do it.
So just so the audience understands, you record it live. Sorry. You do it live and stream it live. Okay.
Correct.
I assume you just use your phone, no fancy equipment.
No, try to do it as simple as possible. So at the end of the day, it used to be on because of the schedules, it used to be Wednesday, and then my schedule changed around a little bit. So now I do it every day at the end of the day on Friday before I head home for the day. And I just pick a topic or think about a topic that came up throughout the course of the week that somebody asked me that I thought was appropriate.
How long are these live sessions?
I shoot for 2 or 3 minutes.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah. I shoot for 2 or 3 minutes, answer their question, you know, and give people a chance to ask any questions on the live platform. Cause you can literally comment live so people can ask questions as talking, or they can make, you know, gestures or emotions and things as we're going. But generally I tend to be a little bit maybe long-winded sometimes, so it ends up being maybe 4 or 5 minutes, which I think is a fair amount.
So what the audience needs to understand is, so you do this live, but then the beauty of Facebook is their algorithms want to show this video more often than anything else that you post. So now your live session, your live stream becomes a repository, or, you know, you essentially have a bank of videos that your patients or anybody can see at any time. And Facebook will put that on your page and put it on more people's feed versus a post or a picture. And then honestly, you can get the video and you could put it on YouTube or whatever else you wanted. Have you considered having these captioned afterwards?
I haven't. That's a great idea. I had never thought
about because
that.
Think about this. How many times that you're in a public place and you get your phone and there's a video you want to watch, but you don't feel you don't have a headphones and you don't feel like turning the volume up so everybody hears what you're watching. But if you have captions, people can actually listen. Sorry, they can, you know, listen to what you're saying. And typically a caption to have a video captioned, there's services. If I can get my Google working, I'll look it up real quick. But there's services that'll do captioning for like $1.25 or $1.50 a minute.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's not bad at all.
No, no. Like one company is rev.com, R-E-V.com.
Okay.
And it's roughly $1 to $1.50 a minute. And then you can have the captions on your video. So that way people can actually read, read your video.
No, that'd be fantastic because I know exactly what you're referring to. But yeah, coming back to it, I mean, doing the Facebook Lives for the practice here, it kind of creates our own little YouTube page on our Facebook channel. So patients can go on and look at it. And I think looking at it now, about 30 or something videos there, and they're each about 4 minutes or so long. And I think most of them get viewed 600 times. You know, and as I look at it, I think the one we did where we're doing a little campaign here in the practice for different things, I think that was over 3,000 views. So it's something that doesn't cost me any money. It stays up on the channel.
And you have all the equipment. You use your phone. That's why I try to get people to understand. And listen, I say all this stuff, and yet I'm too lazy to do half the things, half the ideas I have myself.
It's the thought that you had the idea, right? It's
just and so I think the other thing that I would give you, so what you're talking about doing is a page out of a book about what they call inbound content marketing. And ultimately, what it is you just answer the questions people have. Like, how much does an implant cost? Why does my implant cost so much? What is it expected? You know, should I have pain after an extraction and things like that, right? And and ultimately, one of the things you can do is you can get your team on board with this and simply have them write down the top three questions that they get. And ultimately, you can answer those questions, right? What's the most common question your front office people get? What's the most common question your hygienist gets? What's the most common questions? And then you can even use outsourcing people to write blogs, use your videos to turn them into blogs for you. So then you can blog, you can create you can put them on your website, create an SEO blog out of that.
And that's originally where this came from, was writing a blog. I thought I'm going to write a blog every week for my website.
Yeah, who's got time to write, right?
Exactly.
But so if you record the video and then you turn it into, you get it captioned, and now you have the transcript. And the transcript itself can be the blog. So exactly. you can multi-purpose that. So those are nice ways of doing things. And see, the other thing you'll start doing is selfishly, you should start doing things that you want to promote more in your practice.
Yeah, we tend to do it. I think if there's things that we're trying to run in the practice, whether that's promotions or little get campaigns, I think one of the big ones that we ran recently, we run maybe with twice now the last 2 weeks, is talking about our sleep apnea night here in the practice.
Yeah, and I want to get into that here in a second.
Yeah, of course. We've been running that ad a little bit, or that Facebook Live video. I promoted that and used a Facebook ad for that. And so,
are you recording testimonials of patients?
So, you know, that's the next step for me. That's the one thing that I wanted to get into, but it's an excuse, nothing else than that.
So let me tell you what's holding you back from doing that. It's that you're trying to do it yourself.
Okay.
You need to have somebody in your office do it. There's a product I want you to buy. It's called iographer. If you go on Amazon, I can look it up. I'm typing it in because I have it. Iographer. I-O-G-R-A-P-H-E-R.
Okay.
And what it is, it's a case that your phone or your iPad can go into. And then it goes onto a tripod. And so you get one of those for your iPhone 6 or 7, whichever one you or your team member has, and get a $20 tripod and use that to record videos on your practice. Just make somebody in your office, give them an extra $50, who cares, okay? Make somebody in your office in charge of recording X number of testimonials per month.
And are you recording, you thinking testimonials for anything and everything? Or are you going specific procedures?
Again, so I'm not trying to build a general practice right now, personally. For me, it's very much about selfishly, it's about the things I want to do more of. So our testimonials are sleep, implants, complex cases, but a lot of that sedation, things like that. So we're doing more of that. And we're just getting into, I just finally got a person that I think can head this up for me. Her job kind of depends on it. So we'll see how she does with it. So I got her all the tools, the tripod. I even bought some LED video lights that you you could attach to this as well, because it has a hot shoe on top of it. And then the other thing I would do is for $10, you can get a lavalier microphone that connects into your phone so that you get even better audio. And that might be something else that you want just for your weekly videos. A little lavalier mic, because the sound is that much better
with it.
Yeah, it's $10. Yeah, and all this stuff is available on Amazon.
See, I ordered a lapel mic, and I just keep forgetting to throw it on.
But no, that's what it is. It's a lapel mic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it plugs right into your microphone jack. It makes a big difference.
Does it? Okay, I'll put it into practice on Friday.
It makes a big difference. So you can buy all that stuff. Amazon will have it to you in 2 days. So they make that awesome. All right, so selfishly, let's spend our last 10, 15 minutes talking about sleep.
Okay.
And sleep dentistry. So how did you hear about our class? What was your experience beforehand? And what can you tell the listeners about your experience here at our class?
I came about, or your course offerings, through a separate podcast.
Yeah, through Gary Tactics podcast, yeah.
You were a guest on Gary's show, or Gary's podcast, and so I came about and got made aware of it through there. So I went online, and I found a time that worked for me, so I headed out in August of last year.
What made you come?
So that's a good question.
Because you're not in the Sarah community. You're not in a community where you really understand you're not who I am, but, you know, you don't understand my perspective on things.
No, I had no clue who you were. You know, I heard you on the podcast, and I thought some of the things you said were kind of crazy, but I liked it. That's the thing is you speak, I think you speak what I like to think about. You think in a different sense than I do. So for me, when I came to your course specifically, you know, you present things from a dynamic or from an aspect that I maybe would never have considered. You know, so when we talked about things there at the course and thinking about different things there, it was like, shoot, this is a whole different side of things to look at and evaluate things from. So for me, it made sense. I mean, you get, when you come into the course, you get Dr. Elliott's kind of the nitty gritty of how to do things.
Yeah,
she
gives you the science and stuff.
Yeah, you get the content from there, but you get the actual implementation and how it could work in a practice from you. And I think that's maybe what makes it so beneficial. Is that if you go to every CE course, they talk to you, this is how you do this, or this is how you do that. You need this much millipascals of bonding strength, whatever the case may be. So that's what you get there. But then the other component that I wasn't expecting was the actual marketing and the actual ability to make patients aware of what its value is, how beneficial sleep apnea could be for them. And I think that's why your course actually made it so beneficial for me.
And that was just luck for you.
Yeah, that was just complete luck. Knew nothing about you. I seen there. I listened to, I think you had just started the T-Bone Asks podcast.
Yeah.
Maybe a month or two before. And for me, it was looking for something, you know, that next step in regards to CE courses and things. And then here in the practice, like I said, we have some older demographic. And so we had, before that portion, my wife had made me aware of sleep apnea. She said, hey, maybe this is something you should consider offering in the practice. And I thought, nah, not for me. Too fooey, too hocus pocus type stuff. And then we had a half dozen patients come through with existing appliances that had either broken or were just aged and worn, and they swore by it, loved their appliances, said they never slept better, migraines and things all went away. And so it's like, well, you know, maybe I should look into it a little bit. So, you know, the first couple patients got my interest peaked, and then after the sixth patient, I said, well, I should probably take this course, because if I'm going to be doing these, I'd like to get reimbursed for more than just an occlusal guard when I do them.
Yeah, for the love of seeing that the lab bill is like $300-$500 on these things.
Well, like I said, I knew nothing about it. So when I got my first couple lab bills back, I'm like, holy cow, there's got to be something, you know, more involved than just an occlusal guard for this. So, you know, just for me to get the education and get a better understanding of what I was going to be offering or what I was thinking about offering, you know, I came out to Raleigh by myself, which is probably a mistake. I wish I would have brought
retrospectively, yeah.
My manager,
Interesting. We've learned as well. We our fee now, it's a higher fee, but our fee mandates that you bring somebody, because you pay for it whether you bring them or not.
Yeah, I heard you say that on the cast before, and I think that's completely the way to do it, because bringing yourself out, yeah, you get the science and you get how you'd want to do it. When you come back to the office and try to talk to staff about it or team members about it, they kind of, no big deal. We'll get to it at some point. But when you bring other people along with you and they share in that experience and learning how beneficial it could be, and they kind of get that aha moment with you, it gets them jazzed up in addition to yourself. So the more people you can, you know, enlighten or bring with you, I think that's definitely the way to do it. And so after your course there on sleep apnea, in order to get more patients or more of the team members involved with it, I brought them back out with me when we went to the 3D billing course there 2 months later. And I think that's when it really took off for me, was being able to show other team members why we were doing it and explain the medical benefit more so than just the economics of it. I think that was where it became a big moment for the practice as a whole, because now I sent the whole team up to a course in Phoenix here, put on through DS3's.
Oh, yeah.
They had a course there. So we all went up to there, and now everybody's been exposed to it. And so everybody's been, you know, enlightened and shown kind of why we're doing what we're doing and why the medical benefit is so great. And so now that parlays into why we're doing the sleep apnea night, because they were on me about doing that, because now that they've seen it, they thought, we got to get this out to more patients.
All right. So let's talk about that for a second. Okay. So selfishly, I want to, so the reason we have the Sleep 101 program is so that, and listen, the DS3 program is great, but I think from my perspective, the message should be consistent for your team members. So our Sleep 101 program is really about an opportunity for dentists to send their whole team back to get the same information in a more cost effective way. So if you ever get new team members, you should send them out for that. But, so now something that you're killing me on, because I've always wanted to do it, but I haven't done it, is, you're doing a public education night.
Yeah.
So talk to that. That's tomorrow night, actually, isn't it?
Tomorrow night. Yeah. We're just finalizing things over the weekend and getting everything.
So where are you doing it? What brought this about? How are you making it happen? How are you promoting it? What's your expectations? Give us the scoop on that.
Yeah. I'm happy to. So
what's it called?
So it's just Stop Snoring Now. You know, that's the name of the actual evening, is Stop Snoring Now, Get Enlightened to Why Sleep Apnea is Killing You. I think it kind of parlays a little bit off of what you said in your course. And so we have basically set up an evening here in the practice. We're doing it in our office or in our dental practice. We're fortunate enough that our front area or waiting area or the lobby area there is large enough to sustain the size and people that we're expecting. But we're really just trying to get the word out and begin the conversation with patients here in the area. We've done a good job, I think, about educating the patients as they come into the practice through the hygiene department, doing the screening tools and using some different things to make them aware of it. But when you think about it, I only see, 1,200 patients a year, or what you consider active is 1,200. But you think about how many other people there are in the communities and things. And so for me, that's the big thing. I've talked about it on the Facebook Live videos, had some good experience. And we've run some different Facebook ads related to sleep. And when you see how many people it affects and how many people it pertains to, it's really powerful. And so for me, after doing a couple ads with it, I thought, shoot, am I getting this much response just off a cartoon or an ad? You know, what kind of response can I get from actually talking to people or bringing people in to meet me, talk about these in person, and see how it would benefit them from a medical and a health perspective? And so we're doing that here tomorrow night. We're going to host people here in the practice.
What's your expectations on number of people?
Number, I'm expecting anywhere between 10 and 15 people.
But okay. That's good.
We asked for RSVP. We've gotten probably 5 or 6 RSVPs. But when you look at it, in the way that we've kind of promoted it is twofold. So one, we're going ahead and we send out, we use Revenue Well here in the practice.
Oh, good.
We send out a newsletter through our practice management software. And we made patients aware of it who are existing patients. We actually also ran a Facebook ad or two ads simultaneously, one on a post about the event and the other about the actual, we created a Facebook event and now we're running an ad for that event, which has had some really good traction on both Facebook and Instagram.
Good for you.
You know, so we're doing it, those things. I think when you looked at it, I think our Instagram ad had something like 4,000 or 5,000 likes over the course of 2 weeks.
Okay. Wow.
So. You know, and that's the thing. I was talking to the team about it today, is this could be huge, or we could have, 10 people here. But
listen, if you get 2 people to sign up and move forward, you're golden. Hell, if you get one.
I'm more than happy with just the one. So for me, this is kind of a stepping stone. I'm using this as an introduction to just public speaking about the sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. Created the PowerPoint, did the whole different things to be able to. I bought a projector and a big 100-inch screen that I can project the slides onto.
You mean you don't have a training center in your office like me?
You know what? Not yet, maybe. I won't say no. I'll say not yet. So we're doing that. We're going to have everybody here. We bought some food and some beer, some wine. We're going to have everybody here, some drinks and things. And it's kind of actually coincides with us for two different things. One is the sleep apnea. The other is we just renovated the practice.
Okay. So you're going to do a little bit of an open house.
Yeah, it's an open house for the first half hour, 40 minutes. And then we're going to go ahead and have a conversation about snoring and sleep apnea for the last half hour, 40 minutes. And so we're parlaying it into that, and we're ambitious. I'm excited about it. I'm kind of eager to see who shows up or how many people show up and see how it works for us.
So don't get disappointed or give up, okay? These things, no. Here's what I can tell you from doing courses to dentists. Yeah. The first few don't sell out, and then they start doing better and better and better, and it's a snowball effect, okay?
Okay.
The other thing I would encourage you to do is parlay this into an implant seminar.
Yeah. Okay.
About dentures, or you know, not ever having to use dentures again, and get to a point where if you ever get into marketing or do any marketing in your practice, get to a point where you constantly have a quarterly public seminar. Become in the community's mind the source of education. I've taken some courses that are about talking about how to do these. So in the beginning, do it on the shoestring budget like you're doing. Mm-hmm. In a perfect world, you'll get a better response if you do it at a library. And the reason is because it's going to be non-confrontational for patients. They're not going to be like, hey, I'm getting sold or whatever it is. And a library is a quote unquote safe zone, right? And things at the library, generally speaking, are very educational. I mean, the perception of something at the library is just that it's educational, right?
Yeah, it's a little seminar. It's a little thing.
But absolutely be committed to it. As you get better at these, or as you do more of them and more consistent with them, try to have a patient or two there that can talk to some of the people about how this has worked and help them. Even if it's a matter of a team member or a team member's spouse, that's helped in whatever it is that you're doing the seminar about. Some of those things will help, and keep it short. You're not talking to dentists, you know. Keep it to 5, 10, 15 minutes. And the other thing I would do is pre-have consult times available for your patients, or be ready to offer on-site consultations to where you can do initial screenings, and then also have your HST machine ready for the next few days or whatever, so that you have a, you know, last thing you want to do is have somebody come in, they're hot, they're ready to go, and then you're like, okay, my next consult's 3 weeks from now. I mean, your next consult should be that night or the next day or the day after.
Yep, and that's actually what we did, is we dedicated a day. So I don't usually see patients on Wednesday. So
okay.
I'll set up this coming Wednesday for that very reason.
Oh, perfect.
For consults.
So. And then the other thing you can do with this is you can do an ortho seminar, like an Invisalign night or an ortho night, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So those are some of the different things I've seen people do there as well.
No, that's great.
So give me an idea. So before you came to the course, you essentially weren't doing any sleep unless the patient came and begged for it.
Yep. They had to beg for me to remake their appliance, and even then I almost tried to talk them out of it.
Okay. And now, well, how many people are you putting through HSTs now?
So we probably average, the HST is, we have one here, which I think is the next step. It is on my order list for one of the next months here, is to get another appliance or another HST, because.
And HST is a home sleep testing machine. So yep, for the people that don't know.
We've used the Metabyte Junior here.
Yeah, it's a great product.
From being here at your practice or being at your seminar.
We have four of them now.
Do you really?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's kind of, because that's becoming a hindrance to us, is patients will come through. We do the screening in the hygiene department. They fill out the sleep questionnaire for me, and then they're ready to take the test. And it's like, oh, shoot, can you come back on Tuesday to pick
they're like,
that
oh,
up?
No, Tuesday doesn't work.
It's a matter of trying to.
And then the next thing you know, they're coming on Tuesday, and you see another patient on Monday, and they can't take it home because somebody needs it on Tuesday.
That's literally what we've run into. Last week, it was terrible. We tried to coordinate getting three people over the course of 5 days, and it was just pain in the butt. So. Yeah. Now we're talking about getting another HST, and so Ring having that available. So it's generally running every other day or every third day.
So you're probably putting 10 to 15 people a month through the funnel?
Through the funnel. So if nothing else, getting them interested in it, getting them talk to them about it, because I'll do it like a mini consult. You know, we come through the hygiene department, they'll fill out an iPad that's got a questionnaire, and it'll give them a risk factor based off of their answers.
That's a DS3 software then?
Yep, that's the DS3 screener app. Exactly. And so they go through that, and then hygienists have done a great job about talking about it and explaining why their risks are what they are. So when I come in to do my recall exam, I'll sit down, I'll go through the teeth, and then I parlay that into the next step being, hey, you know, looking at the teeth or looking at the mouth, I see some things here that are risks or indicators of some sleep disordered breathing. You know, do you have any issues sleeping? Are you having any problems snoring? Or the hygienist will just bring it up. Hey, doc, this is Steve. Steve's, you know, commented after his screening that his wife told him that he can't be sleeping anymore, or that she can't handle him snoring anymore. So, you know, can you talk to him a little bit about what we're doing here in the practice with the advancement devices or things? And in a bit of, you know, gimmicky thing, I stole your posters.
Oh, good. I was just getting ready to ask if you put the posters up.
I did. You know what? And the funny thing about
subliminal marketing, dude, it works unbelievably well.
Every time patients, I saw that. I was wondering about that. And just by having it on the wall behind my head as we're talking about it, you know, and I tried to make them about your size. And coincidentally, they got printed out about the size of a poster. So they're huge, but it works out really well because patients can actually see them and read them. So, hey, I thought it was going to be a problem, but it actually has been out to be a benefit for us. So, yeah, HST runs many times a week, and we're getting people into the funnel. We're working with them on that aspect of thing. We did real good at the end of 2016.
Because it should be free for your patients through medical.
Deductibles were shot, so everybody was ready and willing. Now the beginning of the year comes around, and deductibles reset and things. So we've got a standing list of patients who are...
So we call that our pipeline.
Mm-hmm. I you got it on your wall in your break room there. I went out and bought a bunch of boards and put them up in the office. So we've got for each type of procedure. I basically copied what you were doing. So yeah,
that's the point of having the class at our office is that you can see what it is that we're doing. You know, I'm going to change our pipeline pretty soon. I'm going to get iPads or Kindles for everybody in the office. And I'm going to put everything on Google Drive, Google Docs. And that way everybody has a shared document. And that way any hygienist or anybody can see it and put it right away in the shared spreadsheet. So that way everybody has access to it. And that way I also have access to it on a daily basis. So I can see kind of what's going on, what hasn't done it. I can see who's added in the team. So one of the things we want to see now is, I don't want to call it a real competition, but I want to see which hygienists are doing better with this, which ones are bringing in more sleep patients or bringing it up more often with our patients or moving people through the funnel a little bit more often. I want to kind of track that to see where that's coming from. And that's how I'll determine who can make more or at the end, you know, through the practice and things like that. So it's...
That's a unique way of doing it. I like that. I have to look into that.
Yeah. You know, and then also taking the Mallon Potty picture helps. Let me ask you this. So kind of the last few minutes here, we're over time, but that's okay. Anything else you want to talk about on sleep?
Nah, you know what? I've got to quip maybe one or two things on it, but you go ahead. You give me your question first, then I'll return mine.
Why haven't you gone digital?
In what sense? Meaning 3D or
3D and CAD CAM?
So 3D is the next thing for me. That's the next on my purchase list is buying a cone beam here.
You know it's free, right?
So yeah, well, it is free for me right now too. Though I'll tell you this, because I'm fortunate that I've got a unique arrangement with an orthodontist down the road from me.
Yeah, but that's not the same, dude.
It's free. It's free at this point in the game.
No, so I say free, it's free because you have the medical billing training, and mm-hmm. Arizona is a state that actually does reimburse cone beams. So I mean, you're talking about even if you got $150 each cone beam, dude, the machine is gonna be free.
Well, and that's the thing. I think between the different things that we do here in the practice, I refer out maybe a dozen people a month for implants and things.
That's silly.
Capture. So it's, you know, when you look at that, that's kind of where we're at with that aspect of it.
So in all honesty, you're dumb not buying this thing. I don't mean to call you dumb.
No. Hey, I take no offense to it. I know it is because I hear it every day from my wife.
Yeah, but she says it in a truly mean way. I say it in a loving way.
It's a little bit of both. When I talk to her about why I'm not doing things, she said, "Why aren't you doing that? You know, that's just stupid." And, well, you know. So yeah. That is, I agree with you, and I understand that completely because I think that is the next thing that I want to purchase here in the practice. Is getting a 3D cone beam, being able to have that opportunity to offer that to patients and utilize that from a diagnostic perspective for many reasons. I think between endo lesions and things that we find on a daily basis just by happenstance in reviewing the cone beams that I do refer out, you know, I refer out cone beams for endo, I get them back and I'm going through them and I'm finding lesions, you know, on teeth that are asymptomatic. So it's things that could parlay into a much bigger deal for me. So yeah, I would agree with you.
I get it. It's a big ticket item, dude. It's probably half the cost of your practice, you know, and so I get it. It's a big ticket item.
Let me ask you this, because this is one of the questions I was going to have for you, is because now we talked about profitability here in the practice and cash flow is now at a positive. I'm actually able to pay myself a little bit each month and be able to enjoy practice ownership a little bit more than, say, the first 18 months. So you were in my shoes, you looking at things, knowing what things are going and doing things. Would you then maybe parlay any further reimbursement or compensation to yourself to go ahead and purchase the cone beam? Do you think it pays off in the long run?
When you say to yourself, like if you take it to yourself, then you're not putting it in the practice.
Well, what I mean by that is, okay, so maybe the first couple months I was paying myself X, or the first couple years I was paying myself X. Now we're at a point where profitability is a little bit better, we're cash flowing a little bit better.
Do you need that money?
Not necessarily.
I mean, put it back in your practice.
I'm okay living as I've been. I don't need a whole lot, pretty simple about things.
Okay, so let's just use fake numbers, okay? Let's just call it $5,000 more per month.
Okay.
Okay? Take $2,000 of it, give it to yourself, put $3,000 back in your practice.
Okay. And you think that $3,000's best spent looking at a cone beam?
Well, that's hard for me to say just from our conversation today. I think I'm clinically biased towards those things.
You're
doing implants, you're doing surgeries, you understand medical billing. Ultimately, you're going to have to pay for the machine for 12 months, and after that, it'll be free.
And I'll tell you, it's not an if, it's a when I buy it. Yeah. So I know I want it.
But the longer you wait, it's not getting cheaper. Okay, and the longer you wait, the longer you're waiting to reap the benefits of it.
Okay, now the next question would be, buy used or buy new?
Well, that's a politically tough question for me to answer, okay? So I'll give you the benefits of both, okay? So as a speaker and trainer for Sirona... I would encourage you to buy their machine, but that's just me. I love their machine, but there are many good machines out there. Okay.
Yeah.
Look, at the end of the day, it's a $100,000 machine. If you buy it used, it's going to be $60,000. Okay. It sounds like $40,000, but in the scheme of things, you're not writing a check for the thing.
Yeah. That's
okay.
True.
Okay. So what I would say to you to get brand new, to get a full warranty, to get the service and support that comes with a good product that's brand new, the training that comes with the product, typically, depending on what you buy, you know, to save $400 a month is just, it's short-sighted on my end.
Okay. No, that's fair. I think you could.
But how about this? If I were paying pure cash for something, then you're really saving $40,000. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you're not paying pure cash or something, when you're financing it out, then to me, you know, you're making a decision over $400 a month.
Hey, would you lay it out that way? Certainly makes more sense.
Yeah. And that's a personal preference. What machine, what brand you buy, totally up to you. But look, I would tell you that to make a good educated decision, about what you'll buy, and don't base your decision solely on price. It's like when you buy clothes. You don't buy the cheapest clothes. When you buy whatever it is in your life, you don't always buy the most expensive. You don't always buy the cheapest. You always buy what makes you feel and what fits best for you. So the same thing should be with the cone beam. It shouldn't be about price. Price is a small portion of this in the scheme of things. And quite frankly, it's like when I first bought my first expensive car, I asked the guy how much gas it got and what was the gas mileage. And he's like, basically, if you're asking this kind of question, you probably shouldn't be spending this kind of money on a car. So at the end of the day, once you get to that point where you're spending $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, honestly, at that stage of the game, it doesn't matter.
So let me ask you this, because you asked me about CAD CAM. So this is kind of one of the things that I've been debating. Now, looking at things, you look at the kind of the emergence of 3D printing and things, you think, where do you think things are going in the realms of whether it's milling or printing things?
What are you talking about? Restorative materials?
Yeah, restorative, because I, you know, you look at different blogs or different things in the realm of the industry.
I think permanent crowns and printing is...
I mean, is that a... Do you think... and you may... I don't...
3, 5, 10 years away? 3, 5, 6, 7 years away?
Okay.
To be able to print permanent crowns? In terms of printing guides and stuff, I think we'll be there within 12 to, within, we're there now, technically.
People doing it.
Yeah. I think from it, when it comes to removable appliances and things like that, I think printing is pretty much there.
There.
Yeah.
And that's my thing is do I want to get, and this may be a short-sighted kind of problem for myself, but it's one of those things. Do I want to take on the note and the loan of a, for example, a CEREC unit and a milling unit? When maybe 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 3D printing may be a more viable option or more feasible long-term option. And that's kind of where I'm at.
But will it be? So let me ask you this. Do you pay a lab now?
I do.
So your machine doesn't cost you anything.
Okay.
Right? So.
Yeah.
So listen, I'm not going to say you're going to get rid of your lab 100% because you're not. Okay. But 80% of your posterior units will not go to a lab anymore. They'll be done internally. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's a line item shift in your cost. Okay. It's for any CAD-CAM unit. Notice, I'm for full disclosure, I'm a trainer and speaker for Sirona, so I'm clinically biased towards their product. But you notice I don't say CEREC. I say CAD-CAM. I say cone beam. Those are all personal preference decisions. Now, I think they happen to make some of the best products out there. They're premium products, but, I think it's a line item shift. I think this concept of printing final restorative materials is going to be some ways down the road.
Okay. That's one of the things. It may be right. It might be wrong.
I mean, we can barely print surgical guides right now.
Mm-hmm. Fair. Yep. Right? Exactly.
And
it's just one of those things.
And now we're trying to, you know, right now we can print things that are going to be in the mouth for like 20 hours. So you tell me how we're going to print crowns.
If you're doing 20-hour implant surgeries, I hope you...
I don't know the exact time period, but those surgical guides are FDA approved for not long-term wear.
I see, for short-term use. Okay.
And same thing with like the aligners at the end of the day. They're not long-term wear. They're, you know, 1-2 weeks, whatever it is. So printing is certainly going to be cool. I think it's going to make an impact. I think certainly most advanced practices will have a printer in their building within the next 3, 4, 5 years, certainly because they're affordable. They're anywhere from a couple of grand up to 10 grand for a reasonable size printer. So I think, it's a very gettable item for a dental practice, but it's not going to print final restorations. Not in our immediate future.
That's fair.
Yeah. What else you got for me?
I know you've talked about CE. You talked to J-Lo on your podcast. J-Lo talk about you need to take more CE. So you asked me about mine. What kinds of things are you looking to take?
I'm going to Prague next week.
Oh, okay.
I'm taking a anterior CEREC course. I'm at a stage, as I mentioned, where I'm trying to get away from doing general dentistry in the practice. So my goal right now is by the end of this year, so right now I do one filling a day. Okay. So I'm allowed to do one filling per day.
that's your upper limit, huh?
No, that's what we're allowed to do. I mean, that's what my team allows me to do is one filling per day, because I can't hit my number if I do more than one filling a day. And I've limited my time in the practice to 3 days. So if I waste my time doing fillings, I'm not going to like, how about this? And this is not a brag, but this is a fact. So we had a person come in to just last week that wants to get a smile done. And my next appointment is May, right? Which is not acceptable to me. So I'm working a Saturday or Sunday to make it happen. So I have to limit my fillings. But see, what I try to get people to understand is this has happened because of the decisions I made 4 or 5 years ago. The decisions to add technology, the decisions to expand my scope of services, the decisions to be committed to making sure that those services are an important part of my practice. And one of the big decisions, and I don't think you're quite ready for it, certainly yet, but you need to put it on your radar for the next year or two, is you're going to need an associate. Okay. And maybe that's a part-time person, because as you expand your scope of clinical services that you're able to offer, fillings and things like that are going to get in your way from a time perspective of you doing the things that you're capable of doing. So let me answer the question that you asked me. So because of that, my goal is by the end of this year, for me personally, not to be in any networks.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but my practice will be in network.
Yep.
I want to pick and choose the dentistry I do, but my practice will be a full service practice. So I want to be able to do same day smile makeovers, and I want to have control of that. So I'm going to take a anterior CEREC course on digital smile design and 8 to 10 unit cases with my CEREC machine at a high level. I dare never to say it's a quality of a lab because I've seen some of the lab things that they do, but a quality that that I would be proud of and a quality that I could give to my patients. My patients would be happy with. So I'll never be a master ceramist, nor do I think a CEREC machine spits as it spits it out is the quality of a master ceramist. Certainly, I think it can produce quality of that level with the right operator behind it. So that's what I'm doing. And then I tried to sign up for one of Ashley Latter's programs. But it ended up not happening. So that's why I bought his books. So we're going to Dentsply Sirona World at the end of the year as a team in September. And then I'm going to take some, I'm going to probably retake, Spear's facially generated treatment planning this year.
Okay. That is one of the things that I've wanted to do.
Yeah. So I've taken some other seminars from him and I've done a lot of the online stuff, but, I'm a big fan of online training, but I think one of the things online, like how about this? I could put our sleep class online, but you wouldn't get the same thing out of it as being there.
No, I'd agree with you there.
Because a lot of it is in the interaction, the questions, the energy, and things like that. So I think that's one of the things that online training does lose is that energy and things like that. So
now, one of the other questions I was going to ask you is you talked about goals and limits for yourself in your own practice. You know, as things progress, that's part of what I try to do here in the practice. We try to set goals for everybody in the team and things. But how do you go about establishing those goals for yourself? I mean, because they've got to be constantly changing from where you were at as a young clinician to where you're at now. And so what do you use as your basis for setting goals, or how do you establish them for yourself?
So philosophically, I believe dentists or people, generally speaking, are after one of three things. We want more money, we want more time, or we want more satisfaction. For me, I'm past the money stage. And when I say that, that doesn't mean I've got enough already. It just means that I don't need to make more. Okay. So I don't measure my growth by growing monetarily. One of my big goals is, well, I've achieved this one is taking 8 to 10 weeks off per year.
Awesome.
So my next goal is I'm going to measure my growth by being able to take an entire month off in the summertime. To go somewhere with my kids while they're off, right? See, like that's unrealistic for you. Okay. Because literally as a solo practitioner, you have to shut your practice down for a month.
Yeah. Exactly. If I'm not there, we're not making any money.
So that comes back to the decisions I made 5 years ago to get there, right? I envisioned 5 years ago that I wanted to have more time than money. And so I made choices back then to be able to do that. And that involved an associate. To get an associate in, I need to be able to give them some of my dentistry to keep them fed and happy, which also meant I needed to add new dentistry to my practice, to what I do. So those are some of the things there. My other areas of growth for me now are what I can do for others around me. And so with that, for example, I go to team members, not everybody, but the ones I have good relationships with. And I just point blank say, write down your goal. What is it that you want? I learned a valuable lesson a few years ago when I tried to choose for people what they wanted, you know, what would drive them. And the easiest thing to do is just go to your team members and ask them, hey, what is it that you guys are after? What is it more that I can do for you that would make your life better? A lot of times they'll tell you money. And then I say, just ask them how much. I mean, how much more do you want to make? And if they say $100 a month, say, great, this is what we got to do to make $100 more a month. If they say $500 more, then great, this is what we got to do to get $500. And have a clear, transparent goal with them. And sometimes you'll be surprised. Like one of my team members didn't say, I want more money. She just said, I want more time off. I said, great. All right, no problem. I'll pay you the same. And this is, you can take more time off. But this is what it takes for the practice to be able to give that to you. So a lot of times it's about asking people what they want. And so that's some of my goals. Like this year we added, health insurance for the team. So I pay half of the health insurance. Last year we added a retirement plan for the team. So those are some of the things that it's taken me time to get to. Those are some of the goals I have right now.
I think you share some of the, you're doing some of the things that I'd like to do at some point.
Yeah. So
it's good to hear that the goals are reasonable.
But it takes time, right? But
And I'll tell you, Tarun, that's my biggest fault is I'm not a patient person. If there's something I want it now and yeah, I want to do it now. And so for me, that's been one of the hardest things is learning patience as an owner because, you know, you can't do everything you want to do on day one. And so I think it's being able to understand that and work towards certain things.
But it's about budgeting. So here's a quick lesson, okay? In our motel business, budget 10%, not quite 10%, but let's call it 10% of our revenue towards future renovations. Okay? So when we get an edict from Holiday Inn, they're going to say to us, we need to change all our beds and all our TVs in 100 rooms. Okay. The last time I checked, that's not a cheap amount of money. That's $500,000. So when that comes down, you got to have $500,000 in cash to pay this. And you can't take from your current revenue. So what I'm trying to get dentists to do is to really start budgeting all the things in their life. And so I think you should budget, your practice growth, which is CE, which is all kinds of different things. Okay. In a growing practice like yours and a growth phase practice, that number should probably be 8 to 10%. So 8 to 10% of your revenue needs to be put aside in a separate, like in an escrow account.
Okay.
And that way you have it. So then, hey, listen, at the end of the year, you may have $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $100,000, whatever it is that you can use for practice growth. And growth is not just CE. At some point, you're going to need new equipment. Like you want a cone beam. So if you actually had small chunks every month that you put away into an escrow account, some of the things that you want, you could afford and you could visually, you would see less stress in being able to do that. Because right now, when you see X, I want to do XYZ, you're like, well, I got to pay for it all at once because you're not necessarily escrowing the money out over a period of time. So even a few $100 a month at the end of the year adds up. You know, or $400 or $500 a month for practice growth adds up at the end of the year.
No, that's a fantastic idea. Something so simple. I hadn't think about it.
Are you saving for retirement or freedom? What I call freedom?
Not so. Because of my wife and I's arrangement, she does the saving. She's responsible for saving. I pay all the bills.
Okay. So, yeah, but you know what's going on, right?
Yeah, as a family, yeah, we do. Okay. Save as a family.
And you have a number that in your mind of where you want to get to.
Rough number, yep. I think it's kind of always evolving, always changing. Based
And then you have a set amount that you put away every month.
Yep.
It's like a bill.
It is a bill. Yep. Every month it comes automatically off the check, and that's something.
Does it go up every quarter?
It has not adjusted in the sense since we've been married, which is now almost 2.5 years.
All right. So here's what I would say is make it a rule to have it go up every quarter. And I'm not talking about big numbers, like incremental jumps, like $100, $200 a month more.
Okay.
After quarter one, and then quarter two, another $100. And next thing you know, every year you're putting away more, and the it just compounds.
Fantastic, yeah.
I make it to where I put $1,000 more per month in every year.
Okay.
So my automatic, like I literally have a mortgage payment to my Freedom Fund.
No, it's great. Yeah, it seems so straightforward because in a sense you never see the money, so you never miss it.
No, I don't even know I do it. And so I have it set up to where every year the number goes up $1,000.
Okay.
And next thing you know, you just never notice it.
Yeah. But then like you said, you look back at it at the year's end and you know, you've got money available to do some of the things that you want to do.
So for your freedom and or other things, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. So I think that's a thing I'll have to get implemented here relatively soon, get things going and get that aspect of things working together.
Well, Max, I want to, you got anything else for me?
It was just a question because real quick, how do you handle your staff turnover?
Oh.
Let me ask more specifically, do you train in house or do you have somebody that you utilize for training? How do you like to handle that? Because I know you do see a fair amount of turnover in your practice.
We had a lot more turnover than we've, I made a decision in 2014 that I didn't like the direction of my practice. So I only have two people left from 2014 in my practice now. And so we haven't had any turnover in the last year now, I want to say, roughly.
Fantastic.
So we're getting more stabilized there. I do have a feeling that we'll have some more turnover, one or two positions in the next 6 months, but we're getting closer. I will tell you that if you somebody were to ask me, the area in my practice that I didn't put enough attention to when I needed to was having a bona fide onboarding process. How to bring people in. Even to this day, we don't have it. We just throw them to the wolves.
You kind of train within and let them teach each other how to do things?
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it train within. We just throw them to the wolves.
I will tell you, I'm fortunate that I haven't run into this, but I foresee it at some point. It's going to be, any practice runs into it inevitably. So I'm kind of trying to plan in advance for this particular thing. So I was just curious how you handle it within your practice.
So what I would suggest to you, since you're more of a millennial and things like that, is just record videos of what you want people to do.
Okay.
And then make it private on YouTube. And then that way, when somebody onboards, you can just say, hey, go home and watch YouTube for 3 hours.
I already do it with the Facebook video, so it's not a hard process to do. It's just a matter of, like anything, I think, just actually doing it.
And then even recording what your team members do all day long, in 10-minute snippets.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, here's how you make an appointment. Here's how you do an insurance benefit check. You know, and it starts with just writing down an outline of the different things somebody does. And then, literally recording a small video on how you do that.
See, and I think for us, that's been the reason why you don't have, like, yours don't have a dedicated onboarding process to this point. But I think if we can just simply do it through video rather than having a Word document that they read, I think it'd go a long ways to getting.
Yeah. And people do better that way because inside of a video, there's inflection, there's emotion, and there's eye contact and body gestures and things like that.
No, that's great. Okay.
Well, Max, I want to let you get home to your wife and all of that. And I want to thank you for being on and thank you for being so open and honest. And so our listeners can know, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way to, and what is the name of your practice and how do people get in touch with you?
Yeah, so the practice is called Oracle Family Dental. We're just in a suburb of Tucson called Oro Valley, Arizona. But yeah, if they wanted to get in touch with me, my phone number is 520-975-4965. And then the email address that I best answer at is dr.johnson@outlook.com.
The more modern way of doing this is Gmail.
Well, I have a Gmail account, but the Gmail account got inundated with ads and things from some of the vendors and things.
And maybe the porn sites.
Not yet. Should if it is, it's in the spam, and I haven't seen it yet. So I created the Outlook one just so that I could simply answer things and be. So I've got both. I've got a dr.johnson@gmail, and I've got one at Outlook. And the Outlook is strictly for business emails and things like that, so that way I can make sure to get them returned and get things answered in a timely basis.
Do you run Google Apps for your office?
I don't. No, not yet, I should say.
You should. You should switch your email server over to Google Apps.
Okay.
Because you can do it at oraclefamilydentistry.com or whatever your website address is. So they can have Gmail accounts under that domain name. So they can use the Gmail app at home. And then, then all your team members can get access to the drive. You can share calendars. And you can share Google Docs and everything that way.
Be a little more efficient.
You can share the G Suite. So, yeah.
Perfect. Okay.
So, everybody, thank you for listening. I have two asks for you. Number one is if you can help grow our listenership by sharing our podcast, that would be fantastic through your social media and email channels. And number two, if you can hop onto iTunes and leave us a review. And then I have a third request. If you can submit some questions to tbonespeaks.com. That would be fantastic. Until next time, we will see everybody later.
Thanks so much for listening to T-Bone Speaks with Dr. Tarun Agarwal. Remember to keep striving for excellence, and we'll catch you on the next episode.